If you look at a student today at the age of 17, 18, when they get out of school, the core skill they have is taking exams. That's really the core skill they have. They really don't have anything. I can pluck a 17, 18-year-old and suddenly drop them in a village, and the child will not know how to survive. Right? They're probably only going to figure out how to make a payment and buy a ticket and come back.
Welcome to The Learning Circle, the ultimate video podcast for educators and parents who want to unleash the full potential of children. Join us as we explore the fascinating world of learning with the help of thought leaders who will share their knowledge and stories with us. This is your host, Kavleen Kaur, and I'm excited to take you on this journey. Get ready to be inspired, informed, and entertained. Mr. Anand Krishnaswamy is a computer scientist who spent a decade and a half in the tech industry creating innovative solutions. Now he is an educator who loves to see a young mind get it. And therefore, he shares this joy of helping children learn with other educators who are equally passionate about a child's learning experience. He spends his time training teachers, designing curricula, and coaching school leaders. He writes extensively on educational innovations. It's great to have you on board today, Mr. Anand.
Thank you so much, Kali. It's a pleasure being here.
Likewise. So I would start the session with a request to share your professional journey from the corporate world to the educational sector, sharing all the remarkable moments and also the challenging ones.
Sure. So actually, my entry into education was much before my corporate journey started, right? So pretty much since my 10, I have been 10, 11, 12, I've been teaching students, younger kids. But this was sort of the teaching that we call tutoring, right? So there would be younger kids who have difficulty with the maths or the science, and parents typically would look at your marks and they say, oh, he's got 99% in the CBSE board exams, he must be a good student, he must be a good teacher, so, you know, send my kids also over to him and get this thing happening. So there would be, so I used to tutor that kids in the neighborhood. So a lot of kids would come over typically for science and maths, right? Occasionally for English, but it was usually science and maths, which is really where most of the kids were struggling. So I had entered education in that sense much before entering into the corporate world. But then I went ahead and qualified myself as a computer scientist and went into the industry as that too for a while. But I was also teaching on the side, right? When I was doing my master's at the Pune University Computer Science Department, I was teaching at Pune University as well. And after that, I've taught a whole semester at IIIT Hyderabad. I taught operating systems, though. I was teaching mostly computer science related material and content at different places. Even at Bangalore University, there was a program, a satellite program that was done, so I was doing all of that. And I think it's the IIIT experience that made me feel like I need to work at an age where the mind is still receptive in many ways, right? I felt that students, when they entered college, there was a chip on the shoulder, and that chip on the shoulder was a block to their being receptive. For instance, like at IIIT, but there was the batch was about 95 students. And after a few sessions, I told them, see, attendance is not compulsory. Right? Don't worry, I won't report you to your dean or anyone. You don't want to come, go ahead. Don't come. And the next batch, there were only about 7 students in the class. The rest of them just didn't come. And so that's when I kind of started realizing, no, but the 7 were really engaged. They genuinely care and they really understood and enjoyed. So this was despite the fact that I was trying to help these students understand. But then the notion was, oh, how do I quickly become the next billionaire, right? But they have to realize that when you have even someone like Zuckerberg who started Facebook, he was very good at PHP programming, right? You have to be good in your fundamentals. And the fundamentals are not entertaining. They are seemingly boring. You Just building that muscle is important. Anyway, so then I realized I preferred working with younger kids and getting progressively younger. And that's how I got into K-12. So this was still about 2006, 2007. I was largely tutoring and teaching at universities. And then I started focusing more and more on K-12. I was still in the industry, so I was doing this in parallel. So it would be like evening things or weekend events and activities and things like that. So I was enjoying my corporate work. It was immensely rewarding. The experiences were fantastic. And as you mentioned, so I was busy creating patents and all of that stuff. So it was fun. I was thoroughly enjoying myself. But come 2016, I realized I couldn't do both. And especially I wanted to really work in the space of education. So 2016, when I was returning to India, before I got on the flight, I sent in my resignation saying that, you know what, I don't think I can do both of them. And the reason I did that was for the next 19 hours on the flight, you know, nobody could reach out and tell me, Nini, here is a new project. Why don't you try it out? Because that's what used to get me trapped. Every time there would be something new and I'd feel like, nah, let me do it next. Let me finish this and then get to education. This time I said no. But then still some things that I had a freak accident of sorts, and I stayed on for 6 more months at the company where I was working. And then I completely dedicated myself to K-12 education. But I wanted to understand under-resourced education, so I first did volunteering gigs at various schools in different parts of India. I wanted to understand A, under-resourced education, and B, whether it mattered with geography. Did it change with geography? As in, were the problems of South India different from West India, which were different from East India, different from North India? So I was at different places doing that. And towards the end of 2017, I was doing a volunteering gig at this school called Purkal Youth Development Society. This is outside of Dehradun in a village called Purkal. And I had a fantastic 1.5 months of volunteering there. And around that time, Swami Sir was running the school, who had established and was running the school. He said, enough of roaming around and all these fun things that you're doing. Stay back. We have a lot of things to do here. So I decided to stay there. Started off looking at the STEM education, and then eventually I was taking care of all of academics. Streamlined a whole bunch of things, right? So it was 4 years of crazy day and night work and study and research. I effectively created my own curriculum of what I think was necessary to be a good educator. And some of the stuff that you see here, the books from that whole study. So I moved from being a multidimensional person to a largely monodimensional person who was only looking at education, only reading reports, only studying papers. Day in and day out, as if there was nothing else that I was doing for those 4 years, stuff in the edtech space. But then my heart was always with schools, you know, working with children, with teachers. I always wanted to work with children, but then I started realizing that if impact matters, you'd have to sort of move one step above, right? At the same time, I didn't want to go all the way up to, you know, sort of work at the Ministry of Education. That's too remote. I wanted to be very near, but also create impact. So I thought it made most sense working with teachers, school leaders, and all of that stuff, and also with children. And that's where I am right now.
Interesting journey. And yes, and what you told about the importance of K to 12 with respect to higher education is actually very relatable. I think that in K-12, you have a chance to either kill the creativity and love for learning or to nurture it. So
absolutely, I think it's fairly open till even 12. Mm-hmm. I know it keeps dwindling, yes. But even in grades 8 and 9, I've seen children who suddenly, when they are introduced to something, they suddenly feel like, oh, this is so beautiful. I wish I could do this for the rest of my life. So I wouldn't shut down the option even in higher education. I don't think we should ever close that. As teachers, we should never close the door. Students, they can, but we can't. But yes, K-12 is a very fertile space.
Teachers also. Now, coming back to this skill-driven education, what started your interest into this stream? How were the seeds sown, and where did you see the need for this kind of education vis-a-vis what was being offered traditionally?
Got it. So I was always in the urban space, right? So even my own education has largely been in urban settings, metropolitan, largely urban settings, right? So what we see, we think this is it. This is education, right? There are textbooks, there are reference materials, there are experts. You learn from them, right? And education in India is largely very cognitive, and I think it's world over, but let's focus on India for now. And the education that I received was very cognitive, to the extent that till 10th grade, I actually had the liberty, even not even 10th, I think till 9th grade, I had the liberty of doing whatever I wanted. As long as you got the marks, do whatever else you wanted, right? Then parents, everyone said, forget about other things. We don't have the time to gamble. Focus only on, studies. I don't regret it. I realize that it has provided certain kinds of rewards, no questions about it, right? 11th and 12th got even more intense. So sports took a back seat. There was no time really to frolic and have fun with friends. It's like, wait up, get back. You have 5 minutes, get back, all that kind of time scheduling and stuff like that. After that, undergraduate, postgraduate, everything was a very focused thing into landing that amazing job, right? So you're very focused. At least I always thought it's the cognitive space is really what matters, because the industry really where which rewards is is your white collar jobs, right?
Sorry to interrupt
Sorry.
you there, but I think you had this kind of a shift from grade 10 onwards, but I think nowadays this shift happens much earlier,
So
right?
earlier.
So
Sad. It is just utterly sad.
yes. So even grade
Yes,
2,
it's
grade 3 students have their entire itinerary planned by the parents and teachers, primarily the parents. Yeah.
So that happened, and then 11th, 12th, undergrad, postgrad, they all took the same thing, right? So if at all there were a bunch of students who said, oh, let's go play, you're like, wait, that's going to be 1 hour, and that 1 hour I could finish this chapter. Why would I do it? Forget it. Let's just focus on studies, right? It was always like that. And it ended up, and it paid off, right? On campus, first day, first organized, we were at that point, unfortunately, it was the slump time. So it was the bubble had burst, the companies were not recruiting. Still, we managed to get some organizations. First day, first organization, both for internship and for the job, I managed to get it. So I don't regret that. So that choice paid, but that choice also cost me certain things. And I think one needs to be aware of both. One can't suddenly, just because one has gotten a good career, can't suddenly throw that off and say, no, I lost my youth and childhood and all that. You had advantages, you had things that were lost. But then for me, the realization was learning was largely a cognitive exercise. But over time, both in terms of a sort of philosophical reflection, as well as actually traveling, travel helps, right? Because you get to see a lot of things. And then you see there are people who are skilled. They're amazing at the work that they do. They might not be able to explain it. They might not be able to give you the Bernoulli theorems or all those principles and all, but they know what they do, right? And it's around that time that I started thinking that wait, it's that intelligence can't be monodimensional. And that's when I started studying more about multiple intelligences and also went into the space, which is still fairly nascent, which is embodied mind and embodied cognition. Like, right? We're not talking about everything happening here, but we are really looking at the entirety of the body and how that can actually factor in, right? So while getting into all of that space, I started interacting with a lot of people, a lot of different thinkers, philosophers, educators, pedagogists. And I definitely, and it's impossible not to stumble upon Mahatma Gandhi's Nayi Taaleem, for instance, right? And even Krishna Kumar, who's the ex-director of NCERT out here, a fantastic thinker and educator, and some of his things. But I came upon Krishna Kumar much later on. Naithani, while it immediately struck me as something fantastic, I said, wait, that seems, it still felt reactive. So I said, okay, how do we combine all of these things and make it sustainable, make it something that's relevant, irrespective of the era in which we are, right? And that's when I started moving, however you look at it, deeper, up, higher, sideways, direction is a different thing, but moving in different dimensions to realize that wait, it's not supposed to be all cognitive, right? And the minute you make that statement, you're suddenly including a range of children, not just the ones who are intellectually fantastic and were able to go into abstract thinking and answering question papers and stuff like that. You're suddenly now including other children, the children who are very good at sports, the children who are very good with arts, children who are very good with their hands and building things, are able to you're suddenly including a lot, and you're saying, wait, it seems like we're going in the right direction. But instead of just making a statement like, oh, it's not all cognitive, what is it then? If it is not only cognitive, what is it? Right? That's an important question to answer.
Yes.
And in doing that, I started seeing that there is a lot, again, as I was saying, there's a lot of intelligence that someone can have in their hands. And when I started observing sportsmen and how the kind of decisions that they were making, right? So when we say that Tendulkar played a masterful stroke, and you actually just go back all the way from when the ball was released by the bowler, you realize the bowler deciding to pitch it was also a decision, saying that, wait a second, I think Tendulkar is going to try this shot, so let me confuse him with this kind of a pitch or a swing or whatever. And it's also the Tendulkar watching the ball pitch, figuring out where it's coming, and then quickly figuring out the stroke. Now, this, if you were to do it very, very algorithmically or with a flow chart, the ball has gone way past you. It's not, you don't have that luxury of time. So these are like microsecond decisions that are being made. And if they're not being done here, there is some other intelligence that we need to understand and incorporate, right? So when I was going in and sort of mulling over these things and all that, and that's when I realized that there is skill that is important. Skill has to be also given and attributed the kind of a first level citizenship as cognition and cognitive thing, and abstract thinking, etc. Right? And that served a particular industry. Right? Skill is becoming so it's considered so common and popularly available, it's not being treated with that much respect, right? But today, if I were a master craftsman at Ludlow or any of these fantastic places, you are a rarity. You are a painter, you're a rarity, right? So skill and skill development also should be given. That was one side. The other thing, I was looking at the reality of things, right? And I've written and I've spoken about this often. If you look at a student today at the age of 17, 18, when they get out of school, the core skill they have is taking exams. That's really the core skill they have. They really don't have anything. I can pluck a 17, 18-year-old and suddenly drop them in a village, and the child will not know how to survive. Right? They're probably only going to figure out how to make a payment and buy a ticket and come back home. Right? The ability to say, sorry, there is no home, nothing, you have to figure out something to do in that village. Some kids will hack it, right? But most of them will not, they don't have a skill by which they can offer something and be of use, right? So this is one realization. And I'm saying, wait, if you want skill development to have or be treated as a first-class citizen, it cannot be an afterthought. It cannot be a response to me not being good in cognitive subjects or cognitive activities or tasks, right? So today what happens is you and I, at grade 8 or grade 9, the teacher looks at you and me and says, Kavin is very good. And she scores very highly in all of these exams. So she's able to do this abstract thinking, and cognitive processes are good for her. Anand is not. So let's send Anand to vocational courses, right? And there, from there starts a whole degradation of this. First of all, I'm sent there not because I'm good at vocation. I'm sent there because I'm bad at cognitive thinking, right? It's someone saying, oh, you can't dance at all. Why don't you become a plumber? It's like, wait, what has dance got to do with plumbing? As in, how did you figure that part out? But then I'm sent to plumbing just because of that. It's like, oh, you can't dance. Why don't you fly a kite? Or you can't dance. Why don't you go join the army? Like they're highly, there doesn't seem to be a correlation. So I'm not good at cognitive, so go to vocational, which doesn't make sense. Second is, okay, you go to vocational. I'm not even being treated well in the vocational space. I'm not being given a top class institute in vocational space. I'm basically sent to a place where normally nobody else comes. So teachers don't come, or if the teachers come, they themselves are not very highly enthusiastic or whatever. And that then is a spiral downward. I'm not of much use. I don't get, I might get some manual labor job or some kind of a fitter's job or something of that sort. So whereas you would have gone on to the top institutes, there is something called a top institute to aspire for you. I don't have anything to aspire to. I'm just going to aspire to, somehow get a job. You are not threatened by that. You're like, oh, I just have to go to that institute and then jobs will just pour my way. So your path, so I've been given a very stepmotherly treatment, right? And this is sort of the class fairy tale stepmother. I'm sure there are good stepmothers too. But I think the stepmotherly treatment that I'm getting out here is that just go do some, this sort of get out of my scene or my screen. I don't want to see you. And you are now somebody else's problem. Right? So that's the second thing. So when I'm seeing all of these simultaneously, I'm saying, wait a second, there has to be a way to solve this problem. Right? And at that point, what I've stumbled upon as a solution, typical model that schools adopt, and I think most places would adopt, is when they get a list of things that you have to teach or do, right? They keep allocating sessions and periods for that, right? So what, when you said, oh, maths is extremely important, so they'll have math every day. You say language is extremely important, you'll have language. So it's like, in my head, I call that the sandwich model. So you have the basic bread, which is get them to school. And then you have maths, a sauce of maths done. Then you have some tomatoes of language done. And then you have another, cheese of art. And then I need to have sports. So I'll have that. So you just keep on layering. And then if tomorrow the NCERT were to come up and say, oh, cooking is extremely important, please ensure your children do are engaged in cooking, the schools will essentially try to somehow squeeze something, find one more period or two, and then they'll do cooking. So, and then my sandwich becomes so big, I can't even open my mouth to eat the sandwich, which is where the teachers suffer. They say, oh, wait a second, we're not able to complete the syllabus, and you're just adding sessions on top of sessions, and you're re reducing the sessions that we require. How do we ever do that? Now, skill-driven education is very clear. It's not at all prescribing this. What we're saying is, let a class learn a skill, right? And the skill is very localized. Each place has a different set of skills, right? Now, I might be in a remote village in Gujarat where pottery is a trade. So pottery might be the skill I want to focus on for half of the month, right? So we'll bring in the potter. The potter works with the children. The teachers are working with the potter and the children, and they're learning how to make a pot, right? First is simply slapping it and making a container. The next is on the wheel and how to spin, how to throw on the wheel, how to spin, all of that stuff, right? And in 15 days or so, the kids will pick it up. Guaranteed. This has been done and demonstrated they've done it. So at the end of these 15 days, right, let's just take a sort of a, let's say the school shuts down. Drastic, dramatic thing, right? School shuts down and these kids are not allowed to get into any school. We realize that the kids at least have a skill with them. Now, if you did the same thing with cognitive stuff, it doesn't work that way because things get assembled over time, right? So if I suddenly stop at the end of the chapter on adding two integers, that's all you can do. And that's not of much use to anyone. Whereas here I have a skill, I can at least go ahead and become a potter. So that's my first realization. Then I'm saying, we've all done this pot building of pots together. So there was a shared context. There is no reason why I, as a teacher, cannot talk about, well, if I want a bigger pot, do I need more clay, less clay? If this size pot came out of this much, if I want to make twice the size of a pot, would I need this much? I'm already talking math, I'm talking proportion, I'm talking additive concepts, I'm getting to multiplicative concepts. I can teach all of my math concepts in the context of pottery. You could get into mensuration. Depending on the shape of the pot that you build, the volume of it will differ. I can get into all of those things, right? I can talk about surface area. How much paint would I require for, getting this spot paint? So surface area, volume, all of that stuff gets covered. Again, if you want to get into multiplication and division and ratio proportion, all of those things get. A lot of my maths can be covered, right? If not all of maths, right? My personal belief is that anything that we do on a day-to-day basis is the reason why we are learning maths and science and English and history and everything, right? Else why would we learn? So at least this is true of at least the first K-10, right? 11th, 12th onwards, we're doing things which are different, but let's just focus on K-10 for now. So in the concept, in the story of pots, I can create so many stories. My language studies, and I'm translating it from, say, if I this is Gujarat still, I'm translating from Gujarati to Hindi to English. I can do all these language juggling and application and learn very core language skills while building pots. Science of materials, of heat, how does heat harden it? Why is it that you need a proportion of water in this? What is the science of elasticity, of plasticity? All of those things I can talk about, right?
Right.
The geography of the soil that we are using for pot. Where is this coming? Which is a better soil? Why is that soil like this? Why is the soil near the river different from the soil away? All of those things also I can talk. So just pottery, I can cover the breadth of the subjects typically that are taught. So I'm not adding it. I'm saying in while doing pottery, let's talk about all the math, science, English language, la la la, all of that stuff related in the context of pottery. But because it's a shared experience, because you and I are both doing it, there is no question of me ever coming and telling you, ma'am, when will we ever use this thing? We are using it right. So your this question that children typically would ask, why are we studying this? When will we ever use it? Will never arise because I'm learning it then and there. I'm doing it. I'm using it. I'm studying stories and about how something happened to a pot or any of those kind of things, right? And I'm doing the math of pottery and pot and all of this stuff really in real time. I'm adjusting the quantity of the clay, everything in real time. The amount of heat, I'm getting the science of heat, etc. All of that stuff in real time, right? So in those 15 days, I am also studying these things while building. Because there is no reason that I have to do it like a train, bogey after bogey after compartment after coach, right? I can very well do it in while I'm doing it. So the skill driven, that's why it's not skill based or skill inclusion or something. It is skill driven. The skill is driving my maths and sciences and language requirements. Then I move on to picking up another skill. Let's just pick. Just for the sake of variety, let's say I'm going to do something like repairing of bicycles, or maybe even festooning a flower garland, which is quite a South Indian thing, right? So you have those things that there's enough of math, science, history, literature context in each of these things. There are stories where we've had the protagonist get swayed a decision because of the scent of the flowers that were blooming. There's so many such things. It's a very rich space. And you're also including the community. The lady who does this garlanding or the gentleman who does it, they come and they share how they've been doing it down the ages. Why do they use banana fiber? Why do they use a particular thing? Why is it sustainable? It's no longer some plastic thing that they're using to do. That's not sustainable. But banana fibers or jute fiber, they're sustainable. We are automatically talking about a lot of things that come together. Now, in this, while you're learning these subjects and all, there is no reason you can't do a project-based exercise also. Go
Right.
ahead, do a project-based learning exercise also. But this is skill development. So if you notice, if I do 15 days, even if I did one skill per month, let's just say, at the end of an academic year, I definitely have 10 skills with me. At the end of 12 years, I have 120 skills that I can take to the market and actually do something with it. Versus a student who only knows how to take tests today.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that is, and that's one thing. The second is, as I said, since I'm relooking cognitive skill development from these skills, this question of where will I use it, what is the relevance of what I'm learning, all of that goes away. I'm repeatedly learning the same thing perhaps in different contexts. Today it was in farming, tomorrow it is in bicycle, third day it is in watch and horology, fourth day it is in something else. So, but it's the same thing. And hence my mind is expanding amazingly to be able to see the same cognitive concept in so many dimensions along so many skills.
Right.
And yes, and you're also including the community now. So that means the community is invested in the education of future set of citizens. It's not just a school. Right?
Right.
To share an anecdote, we had a case where there were two girls who were studying in our school, and their father was the school electrician. Every day, all that the girls had seen was their father come and fit some bulb or fix some wiring or something. For the rest of the kids also, it was sometimes like a joke, oh, their father's just an electrician. And they would like touch them and say, oh, chocolate, yeah, and all those kinds. So, you know how kids are, right?
Yeah.
One, not as a response to that, but because this is definitely my agenda as well, is like I invited him to teach groups of students and different grades and different classes how to set up, the basic electrical wiring of a room. Okay? And he was very happy. Felt like, yes, sir, I would love to do it. I said, do it. And he was in his element because this is his area. He just knows it. He
Right.
doesn't need to refer a book or check whether this is the right definition. He doesn't need any of that stuff. He is the king of his area, right? So, and when he did that, first of all, he felt a sense of value and pride in his work. The students learned so much. Now they know that they can always open up something and fix the wiring, etc. These girls also started feeling a new respect for their father and the father's trade. Their classmates started respecting them, saying, oh, you're actually your father's top brass. He really knows a lot of stuff. The community shifts. There's a lot of such things that happen when we include the community in and help them drive the education. We are saying, see, you have a skill, you know something. Let's use that. Our skill is to extract cognitive stuff from things. So I am a math teacher, I am a science teacher. My skill is to look at anything and see science and maths in it. So when let's say you are a earring designer, and you show how to do the metal thing and how you do all of that stuff, you're talking your jargon, you're talking your language, right? But while doing that, we talk about malleability, ductility, and how different metals have got this and how something is brittle. I can talk about all of those things. And in the math, I can talk about, how much material is required and what is the volume and how can you charge per unit volume and how hence the rate of different earring. I can do that. I can talk about like a story. Of course, that's a flip, that's a ring that went off. But Shakuntala story, you could also talk about how like earrings went, and you have a whole story around how, earrings were the center of that story. It's a range.
What we are saying is essentially we start from a skill which is primarily non-cognitive. It is generally driven by some physical, it's more of a physical skill. And we start from there, but we integrate aspects of cognitive dimensions. We integrate the cognitive dimensions into that.
Different word. I would say
Okay.
integrate. I'd say we extract
Okay.
dimensions of cognitive learning. See,
Okay.
I'll give you an example. If you say gardening, right, and we have decided to learn how to plant and tend to, let's say, grapes. Grapes means I have to have a framework for the vines to grow.
Right.
There's
Right.
a particular season in which they will grow.
Right.
Now, growing grapes, I cannot talk about, the redwoods and stuff like that. Or you can, but it'd be too much of an extrapolation. Whereas in this context of grapes, whatever I can pull out and learn, the math of it, the science of it, how it has got a particular growth structure, why is that shape the way it grows, all of that is particular to grapes.
Right.
That conversation I cannot have when I'm talking about mangoes. That's a different context.
Right,
So,
right.
which is why I would say you're extracting cognitive dimensions rather than integrating. Integrating has a slightly forceful nature to it. Extraction is that it emerges. It's an emergent thing
Right.
from the context of which we are.
Right. Okay, that's a nuance that I had missed, so thanks for sharing that. Yes. And normally when we talk about PBL, project-based learning, or a hands-on learning, this is what we follow, the integrated approach wherein we are trying to we'll say that we'll integrate a mathematics into the session, into the project that you are doing, so and so forth. So this is a slightly different approach. Coming back to, you mentioned that this has a localized context. You pick up a skill which is used and prevalent in that local area, which is wonderful. That's the way to start. But then how do we, make it more of a, children prepare for a global context, if you understand what I mean? Because they may be learning 10 skills which they see everybody using it around them, and which is wonderful, right? But from there, how do we help them develop an appreciation of the different skills people in other parts of the country were maybe practicing, right? And if we plan to do that, then how do we actually do that, develop that? Because we may not have, teachers and educators who are trained on that. And in fact, I'm going into altogether a different area of professional development of teachers. We'll go there as well. But how can we build a global context in this skill-driven education?
Right. So let's start with the existing reality. Today, forget about global skills, you don't even have local skills.
Right.
So
I would say that we overlook the local skills. We deliberately, maybe even look down upon the local skills, right? So if we are going back.
Yeah, and some schools would probably do a weekend project or an exhibition with something that they have picked up, etc. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They would say, hence we are doing skill development. My point is that we're not talking about skill development, we're talking about skill driven, which means if the Bidri style of work, or if there is some other thing that's a local craft for your area, after having picked up the skill, are you situating cognitive development in that skill? Are you extracting cognitive from it? If you're not doing that, it is not skill driven. It is only skill addition to the various things, right? Because of that, what happens is, again, there's no connection. I learned a skill, it's there, but the fact that it has got to do with the oxidation process that we are talking about in later classes, I will not even connect these two, right? I'm like, how skill was done there, oxidation process or whatever else, and these things are in some other class, right? Whereas when I'm doing this, and I'm saying we will study what was done in order to get the black finish, and I'm saying that happens because of oxygen. Without oxygen, without oxidation, it's not possible. I have arrived at oxidation because we were studying this particular skill. You get what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So the first point I would like to realize in your question is that the local skills today itself are not happening. So what we are doing is definitely one step more than what exists.
Mm.
So today we are at a zero. We are definitely at a one if we did only the local skills. Right. Second, if this became a phenomenon by which globally everyone understands the value of this, then there is no reason why you cannot have exchange programs where I take my skills elsewhere, right, and someone brings their skills here. Right.
Right.
So that's the second aspect that I look at. Now the third could be someone who say, "Oh yeah, that is all only for very rich schools. We are not someone who can do that." The thing is that at least when I was growing up, there used to be a lot of cultural exchange events that used to happen, right? There would be, especially like the Russian festival that would happen, and we'd have Russian artisans come and teach. Even recently, there's a lot of Japanese artisans who still come periodically. Delhi is one definite place, and the metros are definitely other places. They come and do this. There is no reason why we can't collaborate and have exchanges to learn this. This would be my third thing. The fourth would be that even that is only available up to B towns and B cities. I am a school in a particular village, and I am not getting that luxury. I don't have that luxury of traveling or exchanging students and all. But I still have an aspiration of picking up global skills, right? How do I then get my students to pick up global skills? Right, And again, let's just take a very clear cut example so that we don't know we're not talking hypothetically. Let's say we have picked up the skill of weaving, right? So a loom, how to run, you know, set up a loom, the weft of the warp, everything. How do I do it? How do I change patterns? How do I make patterns? All of that is there, right? That's one. Now, there is a different style of looming that is being used, let's say, in the Norwegian countries, right? Or Scandinavian countries, not Norwegian, Scandinavian countries, right? There is no reason why I cannot set up a video call with them and a video program with them to have this thing done, right? Let's take it one step further. I'm willing to go to the extreme. Now, let's say there's a school that says, you know what, this is only possible for schools which have a internet connection. I am a school that doesn't even have an internet, but I still want to learn these things. You cannot deny me that. So how are you going to enable me to get it? And I'm like, I will just essentially get these programs downloaded, set up on a DVD or something, bring it to your school, you watch, you learn from them, and you have local centers of excellence that exchange. And there might be this one hub school which has got an internet connection that will help you out and do it.
Right.
So there's a system all the way to the, you know, the school which is under a bridge kind of a place. Every place can participate in this. Nevertheless, let's just take the worst case. We're still not able to do this. I would say first invest in getting the skill-driven thing so perfectly done for your 12 years of your kids. Your kids are already set up to look at any skill across the world and know how to extract the necessary science and maths and English and history and geography from it, which today no child has. Today a child, if I gave you a child a leather pouch, the child does not know how to approach it from all of these angles and actually extract all that is required. Whereas these kids have 12 years of experience doing only that over and over and over again. So they cannot look at an object and not deconstruct it into all of these things. They've been trained to do that, and from such a young age, so it's in their blood now. Whereas we will always require somebody else to train us to, you know, do these things till we can actually decompose, you know, break down a machine and, you know, look at things and be able to do all
right.
of that stuff.
Right. So, you know, in fact, then the shared context you talked about becomes a global, you know, because we are... we are not just limited to local skills, we are globalizing the skills, right? That brings me to another question about, you know, you just talked about that throughout K-12, they their skills are developing. In this particular approach, how do we scaffold the skills? And let's say we talk about pottery. A grade one student would be barely able to, you know, manage or make a pot and all that. He would not understand the volume. He may understand about the surface area a bit, not about the volume and all that. So how do you propose to, you know, take a child through that particular skill and build on, you know, various cognitive dimensions and even the various physical dimensions, right? Because a grade one child would be able to create a basic shape. A grade five child would be able to create more intricate shapes. So is it the scaffolding possible in this approach? And if so, how do we do it?
Okay, so here's the thing, right? Now I will not try to teach mensuration to a grade one child.
Yeah.
Right? Which means what I can do as a skill reveals what I can extract as cognitive elements for that child. Right? So there is all that I'm able to do is this. And hence I will push, abstract only certain elements. Right? Largely in grade one, if they were able to build a little pot or something, I'll immediately extract it into, you know, making little more items and then having a show and tell game or a story making, all of those kind of things. And then I might try to say that, wait a second, why is this not good to hold, say, water? Those kind of conversations, right? I'm not going to be talking very high level abstracting concepts. So the choice of skill that I would bring in at a grade level is your, as it, since it is the context, you need to pick which skill development you would like to introduce, being ripest for the kind of concepts I wish to talk about. Let me just wrap up this part, particular thing that you're talking about.
Yes.
skill is the context,
Yeah.
right? It's like how you will not take a grade one child to a high-level science museum, or you will not take a grade one child. Like it's even like how as parents we decide, right? Where do we go for vacation? Like if there is a place which is extremely expensive and it's very rich with things, we'll wait for the child to grow up so that the child can remember that experience,
Yes,
right? We
yes.
will not take grade one as sitting in India, for instance. I will not take a 3-year-old child of mine or a 4-year-old child of mine to New York. I will not, because they're not going to remember most of it. And it's such an expensive trip, I might as well wait till the child turns 14, 15 or something,
Yeah.
12 or 13, whatever it is, right? It's the same thing with skill. So you have to curate the skills, and the skills are available throughout. You have a whole range. What are those skills? So I would say for grade one space, largely gardening, building little tools and toys and assembling things and those kind of things are good skills to have. Flower arrangement, for example, right? That's a good skill to develop. Very simple, right? I have a pot, I have different kinds of flowers. There's an aesthetic sense that's developing, there's patterning that's developing, there's a lot of those. Tessellation, as one might call it might just be something you can do here, right? So you need to curate the right set of skills for the right age. That is one. The other aspect is which skill is a fertile ground for lots of conversation and lots of cognitive skill extraction, right? That's an important thing also to look at, right? Look at, for instance, watch repair. Agreed that most people are just looking at their phones and seeing time, telling time. But let's see. Let's just say we want to do, and kids love it. They would love it when you open up and you show them gears and the jewels and all of that stuff, the mechanical clock. When you show them that, and then you get them to repair, the infinite space of what I can talk about just in that context is mind-blowing. I can go all the way back in history, to time, to philosophy, to literature, to time travel, which is science fiction, and everything, all just in that one watch that is there,
Yeah,
right?
yes,
Then you're
yes.
talking about gears, you're talking about springs, you're talking about the mechanics, the science, everything is just, it's crazy. So, but we need to pick it. A grade one kid might not understand and or appreciate it. And their fingers are not ready for that kind of delicate operation also. A grade eight kid might like it. And there is no reason that a skill introduced once cannot be revisited. Right?
Exactly.
So, yeah, you might do pottery at grade one, which is just clay assembly. And then again at grade three, when you're doing a little more bigger objects and stuff. And then again at grade seven, and then again at grade 10. There's no reason you can't do it that way. Right? So, skill has to be, this is a curation that's involved. As much as you would have a syllabus design and a curriculum design, there is also a skill sequencing design, and it also depends on what you have locally. Not everyone has a potter locally, for example. In which, what do I do? So those kind of things would be that. Yeah. What is skill-driven education? Now that's extremely important to understand because there's a lot of other variations which seem very close to it and can cause lead to confusion. There is skill-based education. There is skill education as one of the things that we offer. Right? I also offer music, dance, and other things, and I'm also offering skill development. Right? There are all of these variations where skill-driven education is very clear in its intent and purpose, is that skill-driven education recognizes two very important pieces. Number one, when we have a shared experience, we have something to exchange, and I get the I have the agency and I have the authenticity to then learn because I've experienced something. I want to learn more about something because I've experienced, right? So that's point number one. So I'm creating a shared experience, right? The second is that all cognitive, non-cognitive elements that need to be learned, studied, and gone into are derived from that particular skill and the experience around the acquisition of that skill. These are two very important aspects of skill driven. If these two are there, then it is skill driven, right? Now, why are both of these important? Today, we talk about experiential learning, right? Which means we want the child to experience. But what are we doing is that we're forcing the child to experience something that normally they were not experiencing. Right? For example, I will suddenly take the child into a lab and get them to do some kind of acid-based reaction. That's not what I was normally doing on a day-to-day basis, right? But you're calling that experiential, or you make it experiential or whatever for me. So you are, in summary, you are creating, you're adding new things which normally I wouldn't have experienced. That is one. The second is all the other things that I was experiencing, you're telling me, you know, leave that at home. That's not what I'm going to study. So you're now confusing me. You are not, you're saying, wait, some are to be done experientially, but the other things that I experienced, let's not talk about them. Right?
Right.
Then the third problem that then comes, when I say, okay, can we all have a shared experience? Then the thing becomes, oh, wait a second, how can we do it? Urban or rural school? There are 30 kids in the class. They're all going to have their different experiences. How could we possibly have one common experience? There are only some very fundamental things. Like, oh, it was raining yesterday, so all of them experienced rain. There is a food shortage, and hence, everyone is experiencing food shortage, whatever it is, right? That is why the skill development is important. We have a skill development experience. How to share? Now everybody's experiencing, the teacher, the student, the skilled community leader, everybody is coming in and experiencing it together. And hence, now we can clearly say this was a shared experience, right? So you start with that. So now this is genuinely experiential. I have experienced something. I had fun. I had a fight with someone. I had an argument with someone. My thing didn't turn out well, so I'm feeling low. All of these things are happening in the space of skill development. So the context, the shared context is hence important. Well, now that I have a shared context, and now that I have experiences that I've genuinely experienced, and why are these things also, why do I say local is important? Because when I go out of the school, on the way to home, I'm seeing a potter there. I'm seeing someone who's, you know, festooning garlands out there. I am seeing someone who's repairing a bicycle there. I am seeing someone who's tending to the cows out there.
Right.
I am seeing someone who's, you know, maybe building something and, you know, doing something, machinery and all of that stuff. So these are things that are my experience, and I'm now being allowed to bring them into school and develop a skill. So that's a shared context piece. The second piece is to situate the cognitive things in the experience. Now that I have experienced this, what are the questions I want to ask of my experience? Wait a second, why is this material used, not that material? So now we talk about materials. Why is this quantity, why is it not growing in that rate? Now we can talk about the maths of it. We can talk about the language elements of it. How do you translate it? Why is this as an expression okay in Hindi, but this expression doesn't exist in English or in the other that we're talking about, right? So we have all of them. Where is this coming from? What are the historical things? How long ago have we had things like this being developed? How old is the skill? And what is the geographic specificity of this skill development? What are the peculiarities of this thing? All of that can be talked about. Versus today, you come to sixth grade, hence I am teaching you, let's say, about the Roman Empire, let's just say. There is nothing that I experienced for which you taught me the Roman Empire. I have not experienced anything. And then you have to make it experiential. So we'll take you to a museum. It's like, wait, I'm not experiencing it. You have decided that you have to teach Roman Empire. Hence, you're taking me there. Now, what is the reason? For example, let's say we brought in a chai wala, a person who makes tea, or a tea expert, or whatever. Maybe we are in Darjeeling, right? So we want to talk about the various teas and all of that stuff. Now, we get into the skill of brewing tea. What is the reason that I cannot study the history of tea? And in the process of studying the history of tea, I say, while this was happening, there were adjoining, there were wars happening, there was this development that happened, all of these things I can talk. I now have a timeline of tea on which I'm situating other events, right? That is not permissible today in history study. Today we will study what the textbook tells us, and only in that order, without actually necessarily situating it and simultaneously seeing, okay, when this happened, what else was happening throughout the world? It's like as if the Roman Empire was happening and everybody was sitting there watching the Roman Empire happen. That was not true. They were busy with their lives, right? What was their life like? Nobody's talking about that in history classes, right? Whereas here you could do that. So what I'm trying to say is there are two elements to bring back to the definition. Skill-driven education focuses on skill acquisition, by which we create a shared context of acquiring the skill, experiencing the skill, demonstrating the values of that skill and the products that you can create out of the skill, so on and so forth. So that's the shared context. But once that is done, the other element is to extract cognitive skills and cognitive concepts and elements and all of that stuff from the shared context. When these two happen, then that is clearly the markers of skill-driven education.
Right.
Did that help?
Yes, yes. So that is a very, concise definition of skill-driven education, and you have shared several examples of how to approach that. And the way I see it, like you were mentioning, suddenly our students are asked to read about the Roman Empire, wherein they have never experienced that, wherein in this newer approach, skill-driven education approach, there would be a journey towards that period, right? Why we are talking about the Roman Empire, what we started from the current age, current time in a particular context, and then we journey from there into the the history. So then the students are able to relate that, are even able to experience that, right? So I see lot of value therein, and the learning would not be forced.
Student-centric, right? This moves towards that, because in what I'm experiencing, I will make this and say, wait, if this mud is what is used, what about in that country where this mud is not there?
Yeah.
And then the teacher exposes me and shows me and takes me, okay, let's see how we find out. Let's see what were they using for a cup, for a bowl, for a plate. And we go that way, and then we talk about how our, let's say, cotton, right? Cotton or the kind of muslin that was made here was not made elsewhere.
Yeah.
Which is why trade routes happen.
Right.
And they said, we can't make it, so let's go buy it from there. And that's where we start talking about trade routes. We talk about the silk route. We talk about so many things. Right, those then now become organic. Now I understand why we needed a trade route. Rather than saying trade route was there, you might as well just accept that a trade route was required. Today I realize I have something which you will not have sitting 10,000 miles away. Hence you need a route to take my thing there. And that is how, but let's say it got too heavy. So the person kept selling all the way through. And that is how the culture of this thing spread, and how you will notice that language and food and everything, it doesn't suddenly change. Not even in India, right? If I move from even within states, it slowly changes. And then someone tells you you've moved into the next state. And then you're like, oh, I'm now in the next state. Whereas the food, the clothing, everything slightly, gradually changes. Right? All of this is now possible if you do it in a skill-based way.
Right, right. How do you see this type of education fitting into the current scenario where technology is everywhere, where a lot of things are given, and a child may not be able to appreciate or even understand that 50 years ago people were living without mobile phones. Right. So in this particular scenario, how do you think this kind of education can fit in? And also, have this connect of a child with the current time, right? What I mean to say is that helping him prepare for the current time, helping him fit him or her fit in the current time, understand the technology, be able to use it, and also contribute towards creation of this technology, but also doing it in the context of a particular skill.
So let me bring in sort of multiple aspects, right? Firstly, The thing that I've always said, as technology keeps on growing and now AI and all of that stuff happening, the one conversation that will keep getting louder is, okay, if all of this can do things that I am doing or can mimic me or can replace me or can overcome me or whatever you want to, the one conversation that I think will keep becoming louder is that, okay, wait a second, then what is being human?
Right. Yes.
And in that context, I think there are only three things. Sorry?
Yeah. No. Please carry on. Sorry.
One conversation that you'll keep hearing is, how do I beat the machine? And that's a losing conversation. You cannot beat the machine, right? But there is this conversation. Wait a second, if this also can be done by a machine, if this is also so beautifully done, what then is the essence of being human? We used to say 5 years ago, 10 years ago, oh, we can write poetry. What? Which machine can write poetry? We can paint a picture. What machine? Now already it's being done. AI is doing it. And
Yes.
even original work, to the extent that they're winning prizes against other human beings,
Yes.
right? In poetry and music, all that stuff. So then we have to keep drawing within to understand, okay, then what is it that is human, right? A lot of teachers sort of in a very helpless or a slightly desperate way, they'll say, no, you can't lose the human touch. And I'm like, fair. Can you please tell me where is that human touch operative in education, in the whole education space? And they're struggling. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying, but we need to understand before we just have a blanket statement like human touch, right? So that is the same thing as saying, what is it that is essentially human that a machine will not be able to provide? In that, I see there are three things that machines, that is essentially human. One is the experiencing. I give you an ice cream, which is a vanilla flavored ice cream. I can build a machine to detect it is a vanilla ice cream. I cannot build any machine that will experience the joy or whatever of eating a vanilla ice cream. So the experience cannot be outsourced. You have to experience it. That
Right.
is essentially. And even if both of us have the same vanilla ice cream, you and I are going to experience it vastly differently.
Right.
You will have memories brought in, which I've never even been part of. I will have memories and reactions and bodily reactions, which you are never part of, right? So our experience is unique. It is essentially human. That's number one. The second is, let's say we've finished eating the vanilla ice cream, right? Or maybe it's a movie we watch. It could be anything, right? Whatever we experience is uniquely ours. What we reflect on that experience is uniquely us. You cannot have a machine reflect for you.
Right.
No amount of data provided to the machine can make it reflect for you. The fact that you heard something, you smelled something, and it brought back the memory of your grandmother, and then from there it took you to that bus you were waiting for to go to your grandma's. All of that is not possible for a machine to do. It cannot do it. Your reflection, your reminiscing, all of that is exclusively yours. It is uniquely human. The third and the final piece is the spirit of Kavli, the spirit of Anand. That is you. That is me. Nobody else can have that spirit. They can align with that spirit, they can join with that spirit, they can collaborate with that spirit, but they cannot have that spirit. That spirit is me. That spirit is you.
Right.
In my opinion, okay, I'm not a neuroscientist or a cognitive psychologist or anything, but in my sort of mulling and reflection, I think these three will remain uniquely human. And our education should focus on these things. The more we try to only build up skills on technology, the more we will have things that are become redundant or replaceable. Right? These things will continue to be relevant forever and will then make the rest of our functioning more centered, more rooted, more clear in our head. We are not reacting. We understand why we are doing something because we have a good grasp over these three.
Right. Right.
Now, this is, someone might dismiss this as just pure philosophy and say, let's just come back to reality. How does this happen? So let's go back to your example, or rather your point on Alexa being integral to life, right? Today, to a child, all of our children are digital natives. They just pick up things and they pick it up very quickly, and they're automatically, they know how to do things, right?
Yeah.
Whether you have a school or you don't have a school, they will still do this. Do we agree?
Yes.
So you cannot prevent them from acquiring these skills.
Yes.
They will pick it up. Unless you sort of lock them up and you don't have any digital anything in your house and you forbid them to go to their neighbor's house and those kind of drastic measures, there is no way that a child will not be digitally adept. Right? So that's one. The second thing is, let's again go back to the example of gardening. Now, gardening is the skill we were focusing on. And we are talking about language, math, all of these things, right? We will also talk about how do we ensure that this garden is safe from our basketball game, that the ball doesn't come and destroy something. So we'll build protection. There is also this point where I will ask, wait a second, we were growing strawberries, but now there are weeds that are coming. How do we ensure that we protect it? Now, one is to manually go and pick up the weeds. My next question to you would be, how did you know that was a weed and not a strawberry plant? And you would tell me, I see the difference in the size and shape of the leaves or the plant. And I say, okay, so basically, if I took a photo of this and a photo of that, of the strawberry, and I gave you, you'd be able to tell me which one to pluck and not. So, yes, I will be. And then I say, okay, if I was on a video call and the video was focused on the plants, would you be able to tell me which one to pick and not? Yes. Then my next question is, wait a second, if you can do it just on a video call, do you think a machine can be made to do it? And you're like, yeah. So what would the machine need to know? The machine needs to know shape of leaves and different kinds of leaves and what is the agree right shape and not right shape. What are you getting into? You're getting into data analysis, you're getting into image analysis, you're getting into all of that stuff. So you are getting technology, and then now you can then say, Anandan, if you can do it, why don't we build a little machine that will go through the garden, keep plucking these things correctly, and never pluck a strawberry plant? And then, okay, let's do that. So now I'm building an AI reader. It is artificial intelligence, right? Because it's able to have the intelligence to know which is the weed and which is not the weed. So this doesn't, because I'm acquiring a skill of gardening, it doesn't mean I have to refuse or not see how technology can be used in this space. They all go together. And that is why I'm saying, but now if you notice, the skill acquisition was in the context of my gardening. Not like, okay, gardening, okay, build a garbage sensor. Like, why am I building a garbage sensor? That's not even part of my experience, right? Because now it is very tied in. And when I'm doing this 10, 20 different times, I have a very good understanding of when I want to use technology and when I shouldn't use technology and how to use it and how not to use it, all of those considerations, which normally would not be part of a maker space or a tinkering lab or something.
Yeah, because there we start with a very specific one-liner definition of that you have to build a AI reader system, right? Without actually going into the context of, and then we will talk about, then we will take the children into a field and teach them the difference between that. And so that the very starting point is different,
Exactly. That's why I'm saying. So all of this is now merged, and because they are all centered around the central skill, which is growing of strawberries, I know. So now I can also build a thing to know which when to pluck the strawberry. When is it ripe? When is it not ripe? I can build machines for that also. And then I'm now talking about a lot of things, right? And then there might be someone, a skilled farmer, who comes and says, well, your machine is just going and pulling. That's not the right way. It harms the plant. And now it's teaching me something about a plant, sensitivity towards the plant, and not just focusing on getting a strawberry. I'm now focusing on other things as well, right? All of that is possible because it's all in the central context of strawberry plantation or whatever you want, anything as a matter.
So this is very interesting, and then till this system comes into the mainstream schools, how do you suggest parents approach this skill-driven education, at least in their own, you know, within their own families, within their with their own child, in a very small way, as a small beginning? How do you suggest the parents can go about it?
Sure. So firstly, what I think parents would need to do is stop treating school as a black box, right? Yeah, I put a child in and I'll get a fantastic human being out of it, right? That kind of a notion should first end, which means parents need to have the time. Today, the problem is they don't have the time and or the interest and or the expertise. But they still expect that everyone speak highly of my child, and hence I feel proud about myself. I did a great job and all that stuff. And hence they're largely treating the schooling and the education pipeline as a black box. Okay, I put the child at this end and something fantastic comes out at this end, right? If they could go out of that, then they will see, understand what is the child learning? What are the various things that the child is learning? And then see, okay, this child is doing this, is learning this, and is learning this. How can I combine it? So you're moving now backward. You're not moving forward because the school is not a skill-driven school. You're moving backward. You say, okay, the child is learning all of these things. And all of these things actually all come together in, let's just say, ceramics. Let's just say, right? Or let's say glass blowing. Right? All of these come together in glass blowing because there's colors, there's this, there is maybe there's some stories that they're studying about human struggle and this, that, whatever it may be, right? An occupational hazard, or let's say any of those kind of things. So I'm seeing all of these and I say glass blower. So then I go find anywhere in my vicinity or someplace a glass blower, right? And then take my child on a weekend to meet this person, of course, after having the agreement of that person, that can my child come watch you, learn from you. I'll pay you for all of that stuff. You don't have to do anything different, but I'd like to, I'd like you to be my child's mentor, teacher for that weekend. And then the child immerses themselves in that and does a whole, this is one way. Because then what happens is whatever the child has learned is now suddenly all coming together beautifully in glass blowing as an experience, but also they are also getting the skill of glass blowing. So the child will now know how to roll the glass on the the pigment, or how to blow at the right pressure. You can't just blow, right? And you can't suddenly start coughing and stuff like that. So how do you maintain that? How does the lung get affected because of this? All of these things. And now if you wanted to have a machine do it, how would you get a machine to do it? Right? All of these things can be done with the kind of dialogue that parents have with their children around skills. And then the child then starts seeing a lot of these things tied back, and then they will keep tying it over time also. Hmm. 3-4 months later, they will suddenly say, mom, we are studying this, but isn't this the same thing that he was doing, Taka was doing with this thing? And you're like, actually, that is interesting. I didn't think about it that way. Let's go back and check with him. Hmm. So the next weekend, go back to him and say, no, this time he saw this. Would that actually apply here? And then he confirms it or he clarifies. He says, it seems like it, but it's not really that. It's this variation. And then you're like, wow, I got to learn something.
Hmm.
So I think a parent who is A, connected with whatever is happening in the child's school experience and actively tries to braid it all together into something nice and has good relationship with the community can affect some of the values and the benefits of a skill-driven education locally at home.
Right. So it's a doable way, provided the parents are ready to invest the time, do a little bit of research, and then get involved with the child to learn that skill. Because like you mentioned, glass blowing skill, from there he may have to go into he may have to be introduced to a different specialized person to learn the related skills, and so on. So yes, it is doable, and the parents, yeah.
Sorry, the reason why I keep insisting on the community is one of the things that most of us children are removed from is the sociological setup of a lot of these things. And when I go, I meet the person who's the glass blower, I get to see the kind of lifestyle that they're living, the kind of clothes that they're wearing, the way they are talked about on the way. When you keep asking, so and so, where is that dukan? Where is that workshop or whatever? You get to see how people talk of him or her, right? You then see how their economic status is. What is the kind of education they are giving their children? What is their belief? There's so much. And maybe even while making that, this person is singing or humming a song, and they say that this song makes the glass lighter. And you're like, a song make a glass lighter? But you learn these things, right? And a lot of these nuanced things, like there's this village where they make the tampura, right, from gourd and all of that stuff. There's just so much rich stuff that happens there. A person who spends time, children who spend time there will come back with an enormous skill, which is a dying craft right now. But also all of these things, they'll understand string tensions, they'll understand frequencies, harmonics, everything. There's just no end. And that's what I would say. There's not just the skill. There's a lot more that comes along with it, which is not possible if you restrict it to the classroom and textbooks.
I sincerely hope that today's conversation and what wonderful things you have shared make all of us parents and educators realize that there is so much of value in coming out of the classrooms and coming out of the standard textbooks and actually relooking at some of the skills that we have completely kept aside in preference to the cognitive skills. Right? So that is a wonderful conversation. I have so many other questions about the implementations and all, but I think we'll park them for another session. But I would like to have one question for related to educators that you have done such wonderful research on this subject, and at least I am convinced on the value of skill-driven education. So if there are any educators who are who want to implement this in their setting or want to learn more about it, what would be the right way? Can they approach you? Are there some
Absolutely.
resources? Are there some resources they can refer to? How would you, what is the way forward for them?
So, first part of your question, absolutely. I would love to have more educators reach out and do it. I'm absolutely at, willing to help, and I want to help. And because this is something I believe in, right? This is not, we can, there are so many ways in which this thing can be done, right? And since this is something I would love to see spread, this is not something I'm looking at it from a commercial point of view at all. This would be something that I would really love to see spread throughout the world. The other bit is, do they have resources? Now, very frankly, in all of my research, I haven't come across anyone implementing the skill-driven education, the definition that I have given, right? I haven't. So in many ways, I seem to feel that it's original research and work that is being done. So, given that it is nascent and it's in an original state, there is no reason why teachers can't explore also on their own. They might want starting things. They might say, wait a second, we have a basket weaver here. I don't understand how basket weaving can be combined with science and maths. We can have a dialogue about it, and I can show how basket weaving can be used in our class. And once you get into that train of thinking, right, I don't see why anyone can't pick it up for everything. It just comes for everything. There's nothing right now in your room that can't be picked up. Let's say even the calendar that you have, the calendar design and making could be a skill. And from there, I can teach all of maths and science and history and geography and economics and everything. So I think it's really about doing it and trying it out. And it's not just for skill development. I'll tell you very honestly, right? Even if you look at normal teaching and cognitive skills, whenever I used to interview educators, etc., I would ask them very, very real things. Things like, I say, okay, where do you live? They say, I live in Nagpur. I say, okay, you step out of your house and you walk down. What do you see? Someone will say, I see a banyan tree, I see a kiranaka dukan, I see a garbage bin. I'm like, wait, wait, garbage bin? Okay. Can you walk up to the garbage bin? And then they're mentally walking up to the garbage bin. I say, okay, you know, you're standing in front of this entire garbage pile. Can you construct a lesson on probability using only this garbage pile? Now, if the teacher is not able to do that, to me, it's a sense of they don't believe that their own subject is relevant. Right? Most of the people will look at it and they'll say something and they'll try and all of this stuff, but they're not able to. When you point it out, suddenly it all makes sense to them. But then you take them to a new context and you ask them the same question, they're like, what can you possibly, there's nothing here to do with geometry. I'll say, okay, let's take your washing machine and you're washing clothes. Can you please tell me what's the geometry involved? And they'll be like, geometry? I don't know, shape of the machine. I said, yeah, go, keep going, keep going. And then it's that. I think this is an extremely important skill for teachers to have. Else they will not be able to give the experiential learning that they're talking about or real world examples that they talk about, so on and so forth. So even there you need it. Skill driven, though, definitely you need it. So I'm absolutely happy to collaborate with anyone who wants to try it out. Very, very happy to do that. And if schools want this thing to be tried out, I'm more than happy to travel to the school and help them implement themselves.
Wonderful, wonderful. So we'll be sharing your email ID with the audiences, and you know, I hope our audience is able to have some takeaways from today's session, and then have this immense curiosity to explore the subject further. And you can always reach Mr. Anand at the shared email address and pick his brains and, you know, get him on board to try a pilot at your school or at your place. So that would be a good starting point.
Sure.
Right. So it was wonderful to have you on board today and to discuss this new subject. I really look forward to this being implemented, and you know, I would also like to be part of it. And we will also, you know, bring forth another session wherein we go deeper into the implementation aspects of this.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me, Kavin. This is really nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for giving your time. Thank you.
All right. Have a